This is Scenic Roots Talking Writing. This is the second half of my conversation with poet and teacher KB Ballantyne. KB teaches creative writing, theatre arts and literature at Ray County High School. She's also an adjunct professor at Chattanooga State Community College. Her most recent collection, just published, titled Edge of the Echo, is broken into four sections, each named for one of the elements: fire, water, air, and earth. Why did you divide the collection into air, earth, fire, and water?
The four elements. It was the idea behind the ancient Celtic idea of those being the basis of life. Those are the things that give us life. And, you know, air is our breath, and water is our depth, and fire is our heart and our passion, and the earth is our memory. You know, it was here before we were, and we become part of it. And so all of those ideas are in Celtic literature and poetry. And I think once I had read the John O'Donohue book, I realized that's, and I went back and read all my poems that were mainly Celtic geared. I thought, oh, yes, I see, you know, I see these images coming back over and over.
But then, interestingly, when it comes to water, you begin talking about the immigrant experience, or the emigrant experience, actually.
Right. Well, you know, that's what brought us here, brought my people here.
So when you are in Ireland or in Scotland, and you, as you said, have that sense of being home, it's because of that, that's your ancestry.
I think so. I think that, I mean, I like being in England, but I don't feel at home there. And when I've gone to the cities in Ireland and Scotland, I don't really feel at home, because they feel like every other city I've ever been in. But when I go out into the country, and specifically the coastline, I mean, and I was born in Florida, and so I guess all of that water speaks to me more significantly than perhaps the other three do.
I think it must be very strange to grow up in a place that's land-bound. I can't imagine that, although I've lived in a place that's land-bound for a long time. But I grew up on an island. I'm not sure how that informs how we think and how we feel about things, but I think it must do. So was that conscious on your part? Were you looking to reconnect with your Celtic ancestry?
No, I don't. I said no, but maybe. You know, my first book, Gathering Stones, was written because I was specifically looking. I belonged to a poetry group in town called Rhyme and Chat, and a lot of the members there were writing these wonderful poems about their ancestry, and I thought, I don't have an ancestry. You know, this is back when I was young and didn't realize a lot of things. I thought, I don't have an ancestry. And then I started doing some family research, and my grandmother had done some family research. And when I started looking into it and discovered the Irish and the Scottish, the Irish is my mother's side and the Scottish is my father's side, it just sort of came into being, and I specifically went looking for it for that first book. And that first book was written because of the people at Rhyme and Chat and the fact that they had been talking about their ancestry. But now I don't think I write consciously about it anymore. I think I just write, and sometimes that comes out. Sometimes when I've visited over there, it comes out more. You know, some places speak to me very deeply, and so I end up writing about them, and you see, you know, little epigraphs, I guess, underneath the poem titles about this place. This is where this poem was conceived.
Like a baby.
Right.
How many generations have your family been in this country?
I don't know exactly. We can only go back so far. My mom's side, because we get to a Smith and a Ryan, Oh, and
yeah, I'm with you.
There's there's right. nowhere to go from right. a Smith and Orion.
Right.
But my, you know, my father's people, we were the Balls on the Tyne River. And so that's where Ballantyne came from, because it was Ball on Tyne and then Ballantyne.
Oh, okay.
And then, you know, both my mom's ancestors and my dad's ancestors changed the spelling of the last name. And I first went to Ireland looking for O'Harens, because everybody had said that since my mom's last name was Heron, then it was probably O'Haron. So I went looking for O'Haron. And everybody in Ireland, the kind ones, just said, no, there's no such thing. And the not so kind ones laughed at me. There's no such thing as an O'Haron. And I thought, I know my people came from here. And then I finally discovered that the people who led us into this country had just spelled O'Haron, and it was Ahern with an A.
Right. Right.
And I thought, oh, and it was a very kind lady at Kenny's Bookshop in Galway who said, let's talk about this. And it, you know, when, after we talked and we explained, and I had seen my grandfather's family coat of arms on his wall, you know, the, not like we're royalty or wealthy or titled or anything, but the last name, somebody had printed off O'Haron, but had printed off the correct picture of three herons on a flag. And when I was telling her about that, she said, oh, and that's how we discovered the O'Haron connection. And I thought, wow, I'm so glad that there was an artist, that there was a visual representation instead of just somebody deciding to spell it however it sounded to them.
Oh, ain't it the truth? I you can only imagine what a cattle call that must have been on Ellis Island, you know? I can't imagine. I've also learned fairly recently, you know, that people all the time would say Scots-Irish, and I assumed they meant Celtic and that they were either from Scotland or Ireland, but what they meant was Scottish people who were taken to Ireland. Is that right? It's that way, isn't it?
Yes.
And it was something to do with the Brits and the
right. It
Brits
was transplanting. Yeah, it was transplanting
to increase the British Protestant people. Population.
Right, the British people, because the Scots were considered British into Ireland, so to balance out the Catholic Protestant, and also to give more voice for, you know, their government representation.
Right. And a lot of the people that moved to Appalachia were the Scots-Irish people, weren't they?
Right.
That's where that culture comes from. And then that same songwriter I was telling you about, was he said, well, you know what they call us hillbillies, you know? And so I had no idea, and I Googled it, and apparently there aren't any historians that will support that theory, that hillbillies were Hill Scots who supported William of Orange, and that's why they called them hillbillies.
Oh.
So if your dad lived on the Tyne, then he must have been near the border then, huh? His family.
It was actually down in the southwestern part.
Right in the corner.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'd love for you to read some of your work, and, you know, frankly, I'd rather you choose than me.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because I'd just be interested to hear what you choose. would you care to read one from each section?
Sure. So now I have to figure out which section they're all in. I did mark some that I thought you might like.
Well, I like so many of your poems. So it's not like you would... I say, oh, I want this one, because in some ways, and it's probably because I don't know how to read poetry properly, but they all become of a piece. It's hard for me to think of them as individual poems. Mm-hmm. They're more like individual verses in a long story, you know?
Oh, that's nice. I like the way that you're thinking about that. this one is called Words Circling, and it's from the air section. To make my poems surge and sing, I would kidnap the color and chorus of birds. I'd seize the bright flash of bluebird that combines sky, hydrangeas, summer sea, and mix it with the wren's sun-bronzed song. I would catch the language of sorrow and love that weave through each line of a thrush's melody, the harmony of the finch burnishing stanza's timbre. Hijack nuthatch and meadowlark to pry deep into the verse of trees, flies and gnats snatched midair. Let passion blaze like a cardinal's fire in winter nests when couplets, tercets collide. The shimmery pulse of hummingbirds capture cadence, sweetness and luster so small, discovered only by tender readers. Circling above, blackbird inks words with a silent turn of curved head, listening to the rhythm, the shade, the echo of tears. Mm. All right, from the fire section, Awake a Fire. The fire burning earth's heart howls, sizzles through veins of clay and dirt, roaming with flickering fingers the belly of this world. Tongues of sulfur herded into geysers deny the sky its stars, while lightning sears ephemeral darkness. Hearths smored until morning, ashes wrap the bright berry of flame, spared another night to crowd this home with warmth and light. Sealed beneath our feet, it dances, the earth throbs and shivers. There's a place in Dingle, which is in County Kerry, Ireland, which is called An Fianacht, and I wrote this there. Leaving you in An Fianacht. Waves crest, staccato the rocky shore, then foam into nothingness. Late summer rakes the timothy, ridge shadowing horizon's edge. Clouds scribble a hydrangea blue sky, sweep salty tang to the cows, the vetch. Bruised with heat, forget-me-nots droop, but one pink bud dares the sun, and I bend to its sweetness. At the heart, a ladybug kisses my lips, ocean whispering its secrets.
Wow, what a great idea. What's a vetch?
It's the grass.
Oh, is it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And Dingle, it seems to me, it looks a lot like Cornwall. It's big rugged cliffs.
Yes, only colder.
Yeah, wilder. Yeah, so it's not protected like Cornwall, I guess. The Gulf Stream is what makes Cornwall so warm. We arrived in Dublin. It's about 9 o'clock at night. We came out of the airport, the rain, get on this bus, and the guy's, you know, cursing the weather and all this. Oh, welcome to Ireland, you know?
That's so funny because I just, you know, I guess in other places I do that. I think, oh, how inconvenient that I don't get to do what I want. But for some reason, in England, Ireland, and Scotland, I'm just, this is what it's going to be. Of course it's like this, you know. I'm passing out with heat stroke in Greece saying, why is it so hot here? Well, you know, because it's Greece and it's July.
I find myself reverting to child. Oh, my God, it's going to rain again, you know. But, you know, it doesn't.
I love it. I love it.
Yeah, well, you have to, I guess you just have to accept that, but it gets old. I can understand, especially the kids, why they don't like it. But
well, and again, I don't live there.
Yeah, exactly.
So if it happened every day, I might be saying the same thing, too.
Oh, I don't know. It's just, you know, on the other hand, oh, my God, it's so green.
I know. It's beautiful. Oh, I've never seen any place greener.
No. It's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Would you care to read one more?
Certainly. Your pick.
Okay. No, and I know what I wanted you to read because I love them. There's that whole series of they look to me like haiku, 13 skeins of Irish Noam.
Ah,
so beautifully written. And is Wallace Stevens the one who wrote about the red wheelbarrow?
No, that's William Carlos Williams.
Yeah.
Well, Wallace Stevens wrote a piece called 13 Ways of Looking at a Blackbird, and so this is based off that. So I tried to do some of the same things he did in his poem.
And he was the insurance salesman, right?
Yes.
Oh, yes, that's always struck me as so weird.
Know, you know? Like Ted Kooser working with business, you know, working in accounting. And I just think I totally appreciate people who have a double brain. I have a friend who's an accountant, and it's just, I feel like they're more well-rounded, you know, they've got that business brain, and so they can look at they can look at language things differently. And myself, I'm just completely immersed in language, and so I don't know that I see it any differently. And I just really appreciate people who are doctors or accountants or insurance salesmen or whatever, and scientists. And I think, wow, you're bringing a whole new perspective to language. You know, you're opening up language that, and using language that I wouldn't use because it's not in my vocabulary. So, I like that.
My experience of those with guys who, and it's a lot of them are men who think like that, they had a really hard time with the writing. They didn't like writing, and they didn't, that part of their brain is not very developed. And then I think, somebody like an accountant has got this ability to read numbers the way we read letters,
Right. Yeah.
And that somebody who's got that capacity could also write poetry, that's really interesting.
I know.
I take your point.
I love that.
That's a really balanced person.
I think so. And I don't know whether it's because they're just equally good at both, or in some cases, like before our modern century, maybe they had to go into it to make a living. And so their first calling would have been to be the writer. But, you have to put food on the table. And so what do? You you choose something you can do. So, but then that opens up that field of language. It's not accessible to me. It's just that I'm not immersed in that. And I don't go out of my way to look up a scientific word or a business word.
Whenever I had to do something simply to make money, it drained so much energy. I didn't have a lot of time to do what I really wanted to do.
Right.
It didn't stop me doing it, I have to say. I still kept chasing this, even though my mother thought I was crazy. But
and here you are.
Still doing what you love. You can see how that would happen to people,
Yes, absolutely.
You have a family, and it's exactly as you say. If you have a... Tim Cofield, he's a videographer and musician, and he and his wife just had a baby. The pictures of them on the web, the little one's looking up at him, and I'm like, oh my God, your life will never be the same.
Right.
This other one's got like, you're her whole world.
Yes.
And you are totally responsible for that little being now, and you got to take care of her. So, then somebody says, well, are you going to make another film, Tim? Well, I don't know. I need the money. And, you can see how that happens,
Right. And then you're pulled away from your first love.
Yeah.
Yeah.
By another love, of course,
Right. That's true, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Maybe not just one love. So in 13 Ways of Looking at a Blackbird, Wallace Stevens has a blackbird in each thing, in each section, or a reference to it. And so I tried to do that with this 13 Skeins of Irish Knowing, having something about a skein of wool, a thread, something about that that connects us. One, in emerald fields, braided haystacks, men stagger in the wind. Two, a woman and wool thread knit a home. A woman and wool thread and blanket stitches weave memories. Three, like three chains, the Trinity braids my life, eternal knot. Four, fragments of tweed and old suits patched into diamonds, green grown brown bodes hunger. Braided knots and flower sacks, empty. Five, black leaves curl in September mist, tragedy weaving roots. Six, fog spins low, thick, frost braiding thatch, lake. Ice moon halos the night. Curled in quilts, children witness shadows swelling, their own hollow eyes and bellies fill with winter white. Seven. O lonely women of Kilkeeran, where are all your children? Do you not see how the gray in your braids, your swollen bellies, blistered tongues, sent them searching the blood-dark sea? Eight. I know the hush of midnight, the song thrush greeting dawn. I know, too, the skein that weaves families, though acres of waves churn between them. 9. She suffered the Atlantic, her mam's quilt bearing what was left of her dreams. 10. At the city's shore, she pinned up her braids and left the boat. Dust and ash slipped like a chain around her neck, erasing the last traces of heather and tide. 11. In Kentucky, a second cousin faded into the mines, the gloom too much like strangling, rotting blossoms. Another voyage. This time, iron rails needled the countryside. Ohio sparked into view, fabric of the river pricked by stars. 12. The dress she wore on the journey, now cut for the baby, the quilt. 13. It misted all night, dawn a moonstone over braided twigs. Soon the sun would shine, prisms stitched beneath a gold and smoldering ring.
The ones about the girl that really get me. She suffered the Atlantic. That's such a... But they're like haiku. About 14 words, the dress she wore on the journey, now cut for the baby, the quilt. I mean, there's a whole life in those two lines.
Right. This is the story of my people encapsulated in sound bites.
But they're not sound bites. You know, in as much as a soundbite, it's just like a sort of superficial distillation.
Mm.
This is a very condensed distillation. It's just the opposite. It's like a bud that contains a flower.
Oh, that's nice. I like that a lot better.
You know.
Yeah.
So how do you write like that? How do you begin to write pieces like that? Do you write them as a longhand piece that you distill? Or?
This piece took a long time. I knew I wanted to do something after the 13 ways of looking at a blackbird. And I'm grateful to the poets who have gone before that we can imitate their forms and look at what they've done. I don't have to recreate anything. I can see something that's been done that I think works. And because I like that particular poem of Stevens, and I had a lot of Irish pieces about the history of the Irish people coming over, and so much of it sounds prosy, and so much of it is just too heartbreaking to tell the entire story of things. But when you can work pieces of it in and just give... I wouldn't necessarily say they're highlights, but they're
more like prompts. Iron rails needled countryside. That's such a nice way to express that, because it's true. That's exactly what it does look like. They're sort of throwing these tendrils all over the
right. And then, of course, I was trying to get the imagery of the thread in there too.
Oh, right.
Mm-hmm.
And just, you know, it's hard to imagine what this country must have been like when those people first saw it. Where you came from, Florida, must have been a paradise, I would think.
I don't know. Probably depends on where you landed in Florida. If you were in the Everglades, maybe not so much.
It's sticky and mosquito-y.
Right, especially if you're from Ireland or Scotland.
Oh, it's hot. That's true. Yeah, that's true. There's still plenty of places in Florida, to my eye, you know, where you can still see that.
Mm-hmm.
St. Augustine, a little bit, you know.
That's my favorite Florida city. You still have that flavor, even though there's part of it that's commercialized. You can still go out, you know, just 15 minutes away from the city, and you can find places that are seemingly isolated. We were talking earlier about feeling bad for the students, you know, who are leaving high school last year and didn't get to participate in some things. And, you know, I was reading something just last week, And one of the comments was the people leaving school in the 1940s because they were going to war. Mm-hmm. How many people? And so their year, I mean, their senior year, their high school years weren't what they expected. My mom has told me stories about people she knew in school who went to Vietnam
yeah.
and, you know, and didn't come back. And so her school year, you know, so I think there are lots of things. I mean, certainly COVID is something different than war, but the disruption of it is what people remember. And while we have periods of everything's the same, we always do this, there are occasionally those things that happen. And I think that's one of the things I want to write about in my poetry, is that these are the things that stay, you know, earth, wind, water, fire. And these things stay. They'll always be with us. These are the things you can count on. And if you live in the moment, you live right now and pay attention to right now, you will enjoy that moment. But if you worry about things in the past, or you think, well, what am I going to get in the future? Then you've lost out on this present enjoyment that you could have.
Today is the tomorrow we worried about yesterday. And exactly what did you gain by worrying about it when you didn't even know what was going to happen? And that seems to me, that's what Seneca is saying too.
Right.
You know, that which you think is life is the wind and the rain and the thunder in the sky. That you may not like it, but hey, that's life, you know.
Right.
That in fact, our experience of life, Seneca would say that he actually pitied people who had never experienced misfortune. You've passed through life without an opponent. No one can ever know what you're capable of, not even you.
Oh, wow.
You know, it's what you're saying, you know, it's the adversity that shapes us. Not the comforts.
Right. And what are we going to do with this now that we've experienced it? Are we going to, you know, tuck our tails, tuck our head and cower in a corner? Or are we going to emerge, you know, more like a butterfly? We've come out of that cocoon and let's do something new and beautiful now.
KB Ballantyne's most recent collection, just published, is titled Edge of the Echo. On listener-supported public radio, this is Scenic Roots, Talking Writing.